Welcome back to the Open Source Startup Podcast. I'm Robbie from Cowboy Ventures, one of your co-hosts, and joined, like always, by Tim Chen of Essence VC. And today we're super excited to talk to Sahil, who is the founder of a company called Glaive, which is a platform to build, measure, and improve language models. So welcome, Sahil.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So let's get into it. Why don't we go all the way back to the founding story for Glaive? So where did the idea for the company come from?
Yeah, so I mean, it's been a long-term personal goal of mine to just democratize AI and make it more accessible to everyone and not let a few people with the resources to run AI control it totally. And to this end, I spent the 2 years before I started Glaive working at an AI infrastructure company building serverless GPUs for machine learning hosting. And it was at this time that we worked with a lot of these first internet AI companies that started out building products on top of the OpenAI API using models like GPT-3. And working with them, there was a common pattern that emerged across all our customers that these companies start out using these general purpose language model APIs and they test their product hypothesis to an extent. And as soon as they start to scale, they eventually want to move away from these APIs and build their own AI models in-house. And the reason they do that is because they've got very good understanding of the user and what they expect. So they think they can get better latency, better cost, and just better performance and consistency as well if they control their models. And we tried to do that by just fine-tuning open source models on whatever data they had for their use case. Back then, GPT-J used to be the most powerful open source model, and we used to fine-tune it for them, but we never really got any success doing that. People always went back to GPT-3 because there was no data for the use case. And without the good data, we were never able to get comparable performance. So we pivoted away from that, focused 100% on infrastructure. But over the last year, I think there was this trend of synthetic data and open source growing a lot. And I started reading up on a lot of research on that, did some open source projects. There was an open source project called Alpaca out of Stanford, which basically distilled, GPT-3 into like 50,000 instruction and output pairs. And they trained a smaller model on that and it performed really well. And this is when I got really intrigued by synthetic data and I recreated their approach on a code-specific model called Code Alpaca. And that really got a good response from the community. And this is when I saw that, okay, synthetic data can really be used to outperform these large language models on specific use cases. And I just started building out our own synthetic data generation pipeline. And when the results from that got pretty good, I decided that, okay, I have really high conviction that this can work. And there's a unique insight working with these first internet AI companies. So that's how Glaive started, I think, mid last year.
Yeah, very cool. And I think one thing we want to talk about is there's many, many ways, like you said, to improve language models and many, many ways people are building applications. And as you move from infrastructure to data, I'm sure there's probably some thought process on how you make the biggest impact, right? Maybe talk about like some of the results you said, the experiments you tried. Like what did you try and see that give you that conviction? What are some of the cool examples you can give some highlights? Because I think people understand synthetic data, the concept, and we've seen it in traditional ML. For LLMs, I don't think this is like a common knowledge that everybody is using synthetic data. So like what got you excited and what you've done? And we share a little bit of that.
Yeah, definitely. So when we were initially fine-tuning models at my previous company for customers, we were usually working with under 1,000 samples of data. And that was really low. And the quality we got was significantly worse than you could get out of just prompt engineering GPT-3. And when I started experimenting with synthetic data on some of the similar use cases, the quality visibly was significantly better. Like another thing to mention would be that just open source based models got significantly better in the last couple of years. So that was a major factor. And that's what got me really excited because I could just see, not on any academic benchmark or something, but just vibe checking the outputs, that the outputs were significantly better than what we could get previously. And that was the entry point into synthetic data. And then a lot of people kind of look at synthetic data right now as just distilling large language models, where you just prompt a model with a use case, like an input and output structure, and you get a response back. And we did this as well for a very long time. It works to some extent, but there are a lot of problems with this. mainly hallucinations. So you can't rely on this data a lot for use cases in production. And secondly, diversity. You want to get a very diverse data set to really cover all the facets of knowledge that your use case needs. So we started moving away from this, and like a big experiment we did was that we only used the language model for our synthetic data to take a raw piece of text that is really relevant to the use case from the web or from any data source and transform it into a really clean and coherent data sample. And for us, that was the definition of synthetic data. And that's why we were really able to differentiate from a lot of other people doing synthetic data sets.
Yeah, so I'm really curious. There's so much going on in this space right now. And for a lot of companies, they know that there's a lot of efficiencies they can get or like better product experiences they can create with GenAI, but everybody's trying to figure out their approach. When you are thinking about the users that are the right Glaive users, is it folks who've already bought into this approach of using synthetic data and you're really like the hoping to be the best approach for them? Or are you having to convince folks that using synthetic data will give them better models? Like how much do you need to educate and convince folks that this is the right approach?
I think this is a lesson we just very recently learned that a lot of our effort is going to be educating people because there are a very limited number of people who are actually bought into this idea already. And the idea that not only synthetic data works, but that small use case specific models can actually work for them. Because ever since ChatGPT came out, I think people got used to just using these chat-like general purpose assistants for doing all the use cases. And a lot of people have made efforts to kind of try and beat them on somewhat niche use cases. Like there's been a lot of open source efforts on getting a better code assistant model, for example. And a lot of times these efforts have failed as well in production use cases. So people are really hesitant to believe that this can actually work. So we're really putting a lot of effort into educating customers. Right now, we manually onboard all of our customers just to get them to try the platform and show them that this can actually work. So I'd say less than 1% of the people we have worked with are actually already bought into the idea. We really have to convince them and show them results to make them believe.
And so I think you already alluded to a little bit, but maybe to make it more concrete, what is the biggest difference to have synthetic data for LLMs versus having synthetic data, maybe your traditional MLs? Because we've seen companies been using synthetic for particular use cases, I would say. And is there any particular maybe like things you have to do or challenges when you're thinking about synthetic data specifically for LLMs?
I'd say a lot of the techniques have continued from traditional ML. Like synthetic data has existed for a very long time in computer vision specifically. And a lot of the techniques have passed on to just using synthetic data for LLMs. But I think something that is specifically required for LLMs, because hallucination is like a unique property for these language models. And if your data is not diverse enough or doesn't cover all the aspects of information that you would expect in production use cases, you would never know if the language model is just hallucinating or it's an actual information, because language models are really hard to measure when they're wrong compared to traditional ML.
Yeah, and it seems like there's still a lot being learned about like how to get, I know I have a number of companies, Tim I'm sure does too, that are trying to get high enough efficacy for use cases. I'm curious, a lot of companies are still, because they're in the experimentation phase, calling APIs. At what point do you think it makes sense to drop that approach? Because there's also, because from like OpenAI's perspective, they're still evolving. So it's hard to know exactly at what point it's worth kind of investing in building your own model versus not. So how do you kind of think about user journeys and like when that tipping point is? Is there kind of, I know it's probably not standardized yet, but like, how do you think about that journey of what kinds of applications make sense to build your own model versus not?
Yeah, I think eventually you want to move to a place where people start their journeys of building AI products using our platform, but I don't think we're there right now. Right now, the sweet spot is kind of between when you have a small group of users that really like what you're building with the product and you have a good understanding of your use case or use cases. I think that's the right time to start moving away from these general purpose APIs, because that is also the time. It takes effort to get synthetic data working for your use case as well, because you need to have a very good understanding of what your use case is. And you can still iterate on your use case with synthetic data, but not to the same extent as you can kind of prototype on these general purpose language models, because Yeah, I think I'd say general purpose language models are a really good prototyping tool. And once you're ready to move away from the prototypes and start scaling your product, I think then it makes sense to work with us and just build your own models in-house.
So is synthetic data, is this suitable for all use cases? Like everybody should just use synthetic data in all cases, all sizes? Or there's a particular kinds of LLM usage or training that is most suitable to start with?
So we're not trying to replace the use cases where generalist models actually do better than specialist models. There's a lot of use cases where you actually need a model that knows everything, behaves like an assistant. And we don't want to tackle those use cases. If we generate synthetic data for a use case that is basically a general purpose assistant and train a very small language model on that, that would never be comparable to GPT-4 or any of the Anthropic models. And that's not what we're trying to do as well. I think the subset of AI use cases that really work well with synthetic data and smaller language models are very scoped and niche use cases. So you have a very set expectation of what the input is going to be. And you have a very set expectation and you have a very high need of consistency with the output. So I truly believe that we are heading towards a paradigm where we'll replace traditional software functions with models, so the models as functions paradigm. And I think if you're able to tightly scope your language model in a similar way that you scope a function in regular software, then using a small language model with synthetic data makes sense. And if it's actually benefiting from assistant-like capabilities and like the general purpose abilities of language models, you probably shouldn't go down this route right now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's get into Glaive. So can you give us an overview of what the platform does and maybe like where you started and like how the products evolved so far?
So when we started initially, the first version of Glaive was pretty simply an API to generate synthetic data. You just submit your use case and your input and output schemas and you get a bunch of synthetic data back. And this was just to really validate if customers can actually use this in production use cases. But pretty quickly, we evolved out of that and we learned that even though data is really important, that's not something customers truly care for. It's just a means to an end for them. Product builders really care about the models they can use to build their products and not the data that goes into them. So we evolved into this platform where you can build, measure, and improve. And I'll get to why all the three parts are really important. And the way we do that is through synthetic data. So now synthetic data is kind of the way we empower people to do this, but the actual value proposition of the product is just the building, measuring, and improving of models. And I think everybody agrees that there's a lot of very cool AI demos that come out these days, but very few of these demos actually convert into real products. And I think the reason for that is for product builders, there is no way to have a quick feedback loop built into the AI models right now. With traditional software products, you can launch something, you can get user feedback and iterate really quickly, have a very quick feedback loop. That does not exist for language models. You cannot iterate, you cannot improve language models unless you are talking about like a month long or multiple months long time frame. And that's why a lot of demos just remain demos. And this is the problem we're solving. We're giving product builders a tool where they can not only build these language models, but once they build and launch a product with it, they can measure the performance of the model and the user feedback on the models. And then actually based on those feedback scores, also improve the model on places where it does not perform as expected. And not only improve, but also steer the model in a way where it makes sense for the users, because a lot of times it also happens that you launch a product to a certain target customer, and then you want to target a different niche of customers, and then their expectations are a slight bit different. So you can steer the outputs on the model in a way you prefer. And that's why the entire process of build, measure, and improve is something we want to cover.
So I think from an open source point of view, I remember you announced that there's a challenge about open source data sets, and I'm looking at Hugging Face, the first model we published was around coding assistance, right? 7 billion parameter model, you know, based on synthetic data. Maybe talk about some thought process around why use coding as a starting point, as a way to validate your approach, I suppose. And I don't see any more models after that. So maybe talk about like maybe some of the thought process around that experiment and what have you been working on further off Is there any other open source like strategy here as well?
Yeah, I think there's a bunch of reasons why we did the coding model. So a lot of my initial work in synthetic data was also around code, because that's something I could really test on my own, being a developer. And code models were relatively easier to get feedback on from the community, because people could really try it out immediately and let you know if it's any good. So that was the reason behind doing code models. And at that point in time, there wasn't a good enough code assistant model that you could run locally. So that was a part of the reason of doing the code model. And I think like our goal with open source till now has been to put out data sets and models that can help move the research forward into think data and evaluations. And part of the reason is because a lot of the tech stack that we use internally at Clave for our synthetic data generation or the base models we train upon are all possible because of the open source community and open source work. So we really want to contribute back to that. And I think moving forward, we're planning to move into the realm of research into foundation models trained 100% on synthetic data. So something that Microsoft did with Phi, I think Hugging Face also put out a data set like that. So we are partnering with a lot of these open source communities like News Research to come up with data sets and just research into building better foundation models with significantly less data and 100% synthetic data.
Got it. And can you talk us through who some of the earliest Glaive users have been and like what a typical Glaive user journey is today? Is it usually someone who's already tried to productionize a model and failed? Is it like folks that are earlier stage? Like, who are you kind of seeing as users so far?
Yeah, I think the best Glaive users so far have been people who have actually built a product on top of these general language model APIs, have gotten feedback, have validated their product thesis to some extent, have a small group of users, and then have tried and failed to put a language model themselves in production by just fine-tuning it. And the reason why they're best customers is because they already know the value proposition. They truly believe that they want to own their own language models. So we don't have to really convince them to do that, because a lot of the times people anyways are not bought into the whole idea of synthetic data. And then if they're also not bought into the idea of fine-tuning models, then there's a lot of education on our end. So those are the best users we have right now. As part of our go-to-market, we are solely targeting AI-first products that are coming up right now. I think there's a lot of risks that are associated with that, because the industry is just so new. So the biggest risk is that none of our customers end up being huge companies. But I think that's something we're betting on as the industry matures, that at least some of these AI-first products or just AI-first product experiences are going to become really valuable in the future. And hopefully we help them through that.
And when users are not bought into the fine-tuning approach, is the reason because they don't have the talent to, or they think it'll be too time-consuming? Like, what kind of roadblocks do they run into?
Yeah, I think so for a team to just spend time curating data and then actually doing a bunch of training runs on that and to then test if the quality is good enough or not, especially for early stage teams, the opportunity cost is just so high. And that's why they're a bit hesitant to try that. And the sentiment increasingly on Twitter and everywhere is that just large language models are the way to go, because capabilities are increasing constantly. And that's why they're not bought into the entire paradigm of synthetic data and use case specific language models. But I think that's really on us to kind of, and that's why we use open source as a way to just show people that, no, we can actually outperform these large language models on very scoped niche use cases if you just have a very good process of generating data and then a very good idea of your use case.
Maybe correct me if I'm wrong. It feels like synthetic data is like such a great tool that you can use it in, like I said, specialized use cases. You want to actually have a much better way to like increase the quality and measure. There's a bunch of techniques though, I guess, that is in this realm of like, I can want to get better quality. You know, there's curating data, I guess, of course, there's like tuning, and there's a lot like even further like model merging and a bunch of stuff. I assume everything is all like complementary, like you can do a bunch of things together or choose one or another. Do you find yourself talking to users that are already decided what they want to try and you're just coming in and say, like, here's synthetic data, you know, we already have a tool? Or do you have to almost like talk to them about the various things you could do and you should try mine, or even help them combine multiple like higher quality techniques together? Because I feel like everybody is just not have a clear idea what to do at this point. So talk about how you usually talk to users about this.
Yeah, that's why. So this differs a lot based on the type of team we're working with. We're working with a few teams that are really built of AI researchers and who are up to date with all the latest research. And they come to us and they're like, we read this research on a bunch of topics and would like to try this out. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where we're working with highly technical teams, but they're teams built of regular software engineers who aren't necessarily up to date with all the literature that comes out. But the process we have for both of them is the same. Whenever something significantly new comes out regarding synthetic data or use case specific models, we try to replicate that in-house and benchmark the performance against our existing system. And we basically have reports of all the comparisons we do. And every time we have a new team starting to work with us, we show them all the benchmarks that we have done. We show them that if we want to, for example, compare this to model merging, this is the performance we got on this specific use case. And it's the same thing where we educate them with more data on what each way of doing things can enable them to do. And that usually helps them a lot. But yeah, in general, we're working with a very difficult audience and we need to convince them of everything.
Yeah, I can imagine it's in some ways a little bit consultative at this point because folks are still trying to figure out what they want. How do you figure out how to manage your and the team's time because of that? Because I imagine that you could have like AI researchers that are pulling you in a bunch of different directions or like software teams that might like not fully buy into your approach, but partially need to educate them. Like, how do you manage your time since there's so many people that I'm sure want you to educate them on what they should be doing?
Yeah, we split education in two ways. So we're just starting to put out a lot more technical content and open source work. We're planning that to show people ahead of time before they start working with us, the pros and cons of different approaches, what are the multiple ways you could do a single thing. And the second thing is right now, 100% of the onboarding to our platform is done manually. And we do that because the activation energy for each given customer is pretty high on the platform right now, just because people have not bought in. They're also pretty new to this paradigm of training models. So we do all the onboarding manually. And once someone's successfully activated on the platform, they reach a point where they have a good enough model for their use case. From then, it's a pretty self-serving way for them to use the platform because at that point, they're bought into the idea. They understand what effort they need to put in. They understand like how do they define their use case in a way where they get a very good data set and very good model out of it. So right now, we're spending a lot of time on onboardings and putting technical content out there across the team. But as we do more and more of these onboardings, we're trying to figure out an intuitive way to make this entirely self-serve eventually. But I think that's still a bit far out because the industry is also moving pretty quickly and there's new stuff coming out every day.
That's the fun part of being in this space. There's always something new. I'll be very curious about how you think about, you know, when it comes to working with your customers, right? There's people that are going to use synthetic data to kind of train your traditional models as but existing. You're using synthetic data, you can actually fine tune models and you can have your synthetic data to actually train your own LLMs, right? And we're seeing just all kinds of, you know, trial and errors at this point. Maybe we can talk about like, what's the most common like modality almost to use synthetic data on? Is it all fine tuning, for example, right? Or something else? And also alluded to is I'm seeing models being used in multiple places, even beyond just the fine-tuning and training now. I'm looking at folks who are adding, you know, routing, and you're using little model there to do some kind of routing. So you're adding little model to do better speculative decoding, right? There's actually models in lots of different places, and I feel like data can fit everywhere. So maybe there's a two-side question. One is like, what is the most common sort of like form people use it? And is there any sort of like new and interesting, exciting use cases or ways people are using synthetic data with?
So far, the best results we've got in production are by just regular fine tuning. So we take an open source face model, maybe it's Mistral, maybe it's a Llama model, and then we fine tune using synthetic data on top of it. And that's gotten us the best results so far in production. But that's on the product end of things. On the research side of things, we're experimenting a lot with everything that comes out, like mixture of experts is a big thing, speculative decoding using multiple models. And I think the promise of these solutions is pretty high, but we haven't seen something actually give better results than just fine-tuning a very good base model on a very good synthetic data set and nothing fancy on top of it.
I'm curious, maybe a different way of asking a question along the same lines as Tim, but has there been like a user or a model example where your approach or synthetic data just like really changed the accuracy of the model, or like a use case where it's just been like such a big delta in performance?
Yeah, so it really differs use case to use case what the definition of performance is, because for a lot of these use cases where the delta performance is really high is where performance significantly is affected by consistency and reliability of outputs. For example, if you have a model and you expect a structured output from it, like a structured JSON and something, then it's not so much about the capability, but about the consistency of the model. And consistency is where general purpose models really struggle to deal with. So in those use cases where consistency is the number one KPI of performance, the delta we have of quality with and without synthetic data is the highest.
So I'm curious how, maybe because I never really seen a synthetic data product in practice, maybe you can dive a little bit deeper. What does a user actually have to do, you know, to actually start using synthetic data? Like, do I have to provide you data sets and that's it? Like how big, but and I know more feedback from, you know, going back and forth, or is there actually almost like an RLHF that's happening here to help create something that can cover different things? Because if it's very specific, I imagine you may not always just dump a CSV or you're done all the time, right?
Yeah, I can walk you through the standard user flow through our platform and all the information we need from the user and the effort users need to put in. So just to begin with, if you're creating, for example, a new model on our platform, you begin by initially describing your use case in as much detail as possible. This is where a lot of education has been into as well, and how to define use cases, because people really struggle to do that. But once you have a very good definition of your use case, I want a model that does this for me. Once you have a good enough definition, we basically generate a knowledge graph for your model and the data set, which basically helps you visualize all the different topics your synthetic data set is going to cover. It's like a standard knowledge graph, and you can play around with it. You can visualize it, and you can add or remove nodes from it. So you can add or remove topics from your synthetic data set. And once you're happy with the knowledge part of the things, we have a thing called a schema builder, where users can define a bunch of variables and then arrange those variables in a template. And then this becomes your prompt and the output you expect from the model. And variables are basically all the information you expect the language model to produce or process. And template is the way they're bundled together. It can be just a string you expect or a JSON. And the reason why we do that is because this forces people to think a lot about everything that they want the language model to produce. There's very little ambiguity because you have to define every single piece of information you would want your model to produce. And by doing that, we are also able to just drive more signals for our synthetic data generation and get a better data set out of it. And the third part is a little bit more complex and more abstract to define, is the complexity of the data set. So with the same knowledge and with the same style, we can have two data sets with significantly different complexity. And how we do this is we show users a sample of 100 generated examples for the synthetic data set, and we let them make natural language transformations to the data set. For example, we have a customer running a web browsing agent on us, and like without going into too much detail, a part of their input prompt is an HTML web page. And when they initially started using the platform, the HTML generated by our product was pretty simple, like something like a six-year-old kid learning HTML would write. And they could go in and perform natural language transformations by saying, make the HTML more complex, like real-world websites, and make it have at least 100 elements, things like that. So we really let them play around with each sample and apply those transformations to the entirety of the data set. And once you're through this step, you end up with a 5,000-10,000 sample synthetic data set that you can use to train your model. And training is pretty standard. We haven't done a lot of out of standard things for training because we put a lot of effort into building data sets, and that drives most of the quality. And once you have the model, we let users download the model weights. We stay away from inference hosting just because that's a highly commoditized market now. And when users run inference wherever they want to, sometimes it's on edge, sometimes it's also in the web browser. we let them log outputs that the model generates in production and a feedback score associated with that output that their user provides. And we log those outputs internally and let them visualize how the performance is and drive insights from that, that your model does good on these type of inputs but fails on these type of inputs. And you can improve the model by actually adding certain information, changing style, or adding complexity. And then the user can go into the platform, make these changes to the existing data set, come up with a new version, and then improve the model.
Yeah, it's so interesting hearing you walk through the user flow, because I imagine one of the things that's going to be toughest is just getting users to put in the effort up front, because with using large language models, you get less accuracy, but you get responses right away. So just that quick feedback cycle is something that they're going to have to kind of like give up in this approach in order to get higher accuracy. I've got maybe a silly question, but what's the difference between synthetic data versus just cleaning data?
Yeah. So for cleaning data, you actually need a very good raw data set to begin with. So if we were like a data cleaning product, we would expect unclean data set from our users. But the difference with synthetic data set is that we don't expect any data from our users. We just expect a good definition of the use case and for them to put in the effort to design their data set, but they don't have to bring even a single sample of data with them.
I'm sure we can always find papers and blog posts to show synthetic data done well. I've also seen research papers and blog posts where data curation done well. There's even found comparisons between, I forgot what the name of it, but like there's this existing model where I tried synthetic data set and I tried data curation and one of them did well, one of them did other. So I guess maybe that was the original question earlier was like, do you find people trying both? But yeah, it's really interesting to see how synthetic data is not as widely spread yet or even widely tried yet, I would say. Is this for now, are you offering just purely like structured data or are you doing images and this like multimodal at the moment? Like what kind of multimodal support you have at the moment?
So right now we are not doing multimodal. We don't have any plans to do that in the next year, at least, because we're focusing only on text-based models, because I think like a lot of the text use cases are blocked on the specific problems you talked about. I think the problem statement is a bit different for multimodal models, and especially image and audio models. And the synthetic data generation for those modalities would be significantly different to what we have right now. So we haven't made plans to go multimodal yet.
You talked a bit about how you're using content to try and drive education. Like, what is your content strategy? Because I imagine that's also quite time consuming. So how are you kind of, do you have like a cadence or certain things that have worked so far, like learnings from other founders?
Yeah, so we're pretty early in our content strategy. We're just starting putting more content out. A thing that we do regularly is we do a weekly dev diary where we walk through everything that we shipped. It's kind of like a changelog, but we also talk about all the ML-related problems we face doing that because we run a lot of ML inference ourselves. We have a lot of infrastructure. So that helps a lot of technical folks resonate with the content. And through that, we can also drive a lot of the definition of what we have. So like the three steps that I talked about for building a data set on Glaive, we have a content piece that says what's a good data set. And every time we try to refer those content pieces in our docs as well as the dev diaries are pretty much onboarding or anywhere we think a user might see that, because we're coming up with a lot of definitions of these things because they don't exist yet. Nobody knows what a good data set is in very unambiguous terms. So we are trying to build good definitions of everything so that we can easily convince people, show people that, okay, this is what a good data set is. And by that definition, the data set we provide to you is a really good data set.
Are you mostly seeing people want to fine-tune like OpenAI and Anthropic type of, you know, closed models or mostly open source models you can just take from Hugging Face or whatever? Is both being pretty popular or just purely just open source?
So right now we just do open source. We don't give people the option to fine-tune OpenAI models. We have replaced fine-tune GPT-3 for some users, but I think a lot of users have seen that there are diminishing returns to fine-tuning these very large language models, and the cost and the latency trade-off just doesn't make sense there.
Awesome. And there has been a ton of just momentum and fundraising happening in the space. Would love to get your perspective on maybe what was hard versus maybe easier than expected fundraising for, I think you raised your seed round pretty recently, right?
Yeah, we raised our seed round in mid-August last year.
Yeah. So what was maybe like at that point in time, was it pretty easy because there was just so much interest from VCs? Like, how did you think about that?
Yeah, I think I expected the process to be significantly more difficult than I imagined to be because I was a first-time founder, a solo founder, and pre-revenue. So I expected it to be a lot more challenging than it was. But I think the thing really helped with fundraise was the unique insight that I have built up over the past 2 years working with these first internet AI companies. And second thing that really helped was the open source work I did was really a good proof of work and a proof of concept that this process can work, this process can scale, and there's community feedback that our community validation that the quality is actually good there. So that made things significantly, not easier, but just better, I would say. The thing that was a bit hard was the same, that making investors buy into the new paradigm, because a lot of the investors are also just bought into the paradigm of these very large language models because they may be financially motivated by that, or they have a lot of data points from their existing portfolio companies that show that that's the way to go. So I faced a lot of problems with some investors, just convincing them of the new paradigm that I'm really trying to build. But I think that's just with any use case or any time when you're fundraising, you have to find the right investor.
So I guess maybe a more general question, what has been the most challenging for you, you know, doing this so far? What are the things you thought? Fundraising probably just part of it. What would be like the number one challenge you feel like is the hardest right now in doing this?
Yeah, there's been a bunch of challenges which I do not expect. Number one was building a team. I think raising capital is relatively easier than it was a few years ago. And that's resulting in a lot of very good engineers wanting to be founders and reducing the size of the talent pool, which is good for the engineers who are becoming founders, but makes it a bit difficult to hire those people. Another thing would be just, I think, focus as a company, because there's so many new things happening every day. It's really hard to keep your heads down and focus on the one problem statement that you're trying to work on. So working through that and keeping the entire organization focused on the vision of the company has been more challenging than I thought it would be.
Awesome. And our final question that we love to ask, any advice for other early stage, maybe founders that haven't raised yet in the AI space that are out building?
The one piece of advice I usually have is, because the industry is moving so fast, instead of focusing problems that are problems right now, I think funds should really focus on solving problems that will be still relevant in the next few months, next few years, because it's kind of like skating ahead of the puck here, because model capabilities are evolving rapidly. So a lot of the problems that exist right now may not exist in the future. It's even more significant in infrastructure because the cost and latency of running these models is going to go down significantly, and that's going to open up a lot more use cases which founders can tackle and also get rid of a lot of existing problems. But this will also result in new problems, and I think founders should focus on problems of the future.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and also something that, because the space is moving so quickly, something might be an acute pain now, but all of a sudden model updates can suddenly change that. This was a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for joining us, Sahil. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great to speak with you guys.